This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commmavia.com.
Welcome to the Airplane Geeks, the show where we talk aviation. I'm Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog, and despite the fact that the rest of the government workers, I think except maybe for air traffic controllers and some technicians, are off this week and probably the rest of the week, we're here to provide some incredible content about the aviation industry, and I'm joined by a couple of incredibly noteworthy co-hosts tonight. Let's start with the city of brotherly love. David Vanderhoof, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm here. It's kind of strange hearing that coming from a Chicagoan. Hi, folks. Looking forward to a good show tonight. We're going to be talking about biplanes, as far as I'm concerned, because that's our guest part of the career that I want to talk about.
Well, okay, we'll be getting to that, but we can't do that before we talk to our other co-host in speaking to us from a tent on a farm in Connecticut. Max, how are you?
Hi, Rob. I'm great. Hello, everybody.
And you're not really in a tent, I don't think, are you?
No, I'm in a shack.
A shack.
Yes.
There you go.
Yes.
Oh, well, that's not so bad. Well, we've got really a great show tonight because our guest is Randy Brooks from Aircraft Performance Solutions, APS. And for many of you that may never have heard of APS, I can tell you that I had a chance to go out and visit their organization out in Arizona last year. And they basically provide, well, not basically, they do provide upset prevention and recovery techniques, which is essentially how pilots keep the blue side up and the brown side down in all kinds of situations. So, Randy, I'd like to welcome you if you're with us, and we're going to talk about a little bit of APS. And are you out there, Randy?
I am happy to be joining you from the Arlington Municipal Airport in Arlington, Texas, which is the location of Aviation Performance Solutions Texas base. We also have our headquarters in Phoenix at the Phoenix Mesa Gateway Airport. Some of your older Air Force pilots would remember it as Williams Air Force Base or just good old Willie, which is where the company has six of the seven aircraft in our North American fleet. And then we have a third location in the Netherlands for APS Europe. Happy to be with you, gentlemen.
Wow, that's pretty extensive. Well, Randy, just tell our listeners before we get started a little bit, what exactly does APS do? I'm sure I oversimplified.
Well, Aviation Performance Solutions' core business is upset prevention and recovery training, but we came to it through a little bit of a roundabout path. The company was born as a fighter combat, you know, adventure ride giving company up in Canada back in 1996. It took them 4 years to figure out that Arizona has better weather than Canada, and they made the move south and set up operations in the Phoenix area. And over the years, there was more and more demand for the core skills of the instructors in the aircraft in aerobatics and later upset recovery, which now has settled in with the name upset prevention and recovery training. And so that now constitutes over 95% of our business. Our clientele is really covers the spectrum of aviation from private pilots and aircraft owners and operators to the U.S. Army, Army, where we train a very large number of Army fixed-wing pilots. The interesting part about training them is that we can have very experienced aviators with some 3,000, 5,000 hours that are brand new to fixed-wing flying, because the Army starts most of their folks off, essentially all of their folks off, in helicopters first. And so this is a way to really accelerate their learning in fixed-wing flying. And they have some incredibly challenging missions, flying at night over the mountains of Afghanistan at very slow speeds while they're trying to keep their eyes on things. And so we're happy to be able to impart some of our skills and techniques to them. We also do a great deal of flying for Bombardier through their Leading Edge program. Every new owner of a Learjet, Global Express, or Challenger aircraft gets two seats in entitlement training with Aviation Performance Solutions. And the course that they go through consists not only of four aircraft flights, but then we transition them to a full flight simulator so that they can use the skills that were introduced in our aerobatic aircraft in an environment that is more like what they fly at work with a multi-engine turbine side-by-side crew. And then we can practice utilizing CRM, crew resource management, in dealing with aircraft upsets. And what's kind of interesting about that is that for all of the other abnormal procedures and emergencies that are practiced in a simulator environment, the crews are usually taught to work together. But the way training in unusual attitudes typically takes place in the simulator is they say, Max, you screw up the airplane for Rob. Rob, you screw up the airplane for Max. And don't help him, because we want to see if he can figure it out on his own. And so it really doesn't accommodate the crew mutual support that is present in most other emergency situations, even though most people are probably not aware, but loss of control in flight is the number one cause of fatalities in both general aviation and commercial aviation worldwide.
Well, I think that it sounds like we're going to have a really interesting chat here in a little bit about all this, because I'm sure a lot of our listeners are probably wondering just why upset prevention and recovery training has become such a big deal over the last few years. But we'll get to that in just a little bit. And of course, later on, we're going to have Max. I think we still have to have the guys from Down Under on, I guess, right? No matter what.
Oh, well, they sent us a really nice Australia desk report. So, of course, we'll play that.
What, did they talk funny on this one again?
They have some things to say about David this time.
Oh, well, that should be interesting. And David, I think you're going to have an airplane of the week.
Actually, I'm not having an airplane of the week. And the reason why is because we got some early entries to the You Want to Be a Historian segment. So congratulations, Tom. We're going to be talking about your cozy Mark IV that you wrote.
And then, of course, we're going to be doing some listener mail, and I think it's going to be a pretty full show, so I think we ought to get right to it. I mean,
and don't forget, across the pond, we'll have Peter on, correct?
That's right. Peter's going to talk to Tony Bishop, who's the co-founder and director of Ego Airplanes.
I knew that, Peter. I was just fooling you to see if one of those guys were going to pick it up, and they did, so... Thank you, guys. So now maybe we can get out of the news. What do you think?
Let's do it.
Whew. Well, what a week this has been for the folks of the United States and our territories, because everything in the United States government has been shut down for a week. And so our first story actually came from Forbes magazine at Forbes.com, and John Goglia, who is a former NTSB inspector, in fact, the only man on the NTSB to have ever been on the board, who is a maintenance technician, wrote a really interesting piece early last week about how the furloughs have sent some people home that might be a little more important than people gave them credit for, which are the air carrier and the general aviation safety inspectors. and the people that, of course, many of us know handle the check rides and that sort of thing. But John was wondering whether us furloughing those people might not violate an international aviation treaty that says that in the United States we would be responsible for checking the air carriers and everybody that flies to make sure everybody's operating safely. And right now, the hen house is closed. So we're trying to figure out what to do with that. I mean, I don't know. What do you guys think about that? Have you guys thought about the fact that no one may be flying around these days that is safe or unsafe or what have you?
Well, it's certainly a lot of employees furloughed, Rob, from the FAA. We've got 3,000 of them, the aviation safety inspectors, as you mentioned, NTSB. That's a lot of folks that do a lot of important work, and that work is just not getting done. But you mentioned the treaty, the Chicago Convention, or maybe it's more formally the Convention on International Civil Aviation. This convention, it was signed by the initial parties way back in 1944, and this is what created ICAO, the International Civil Air Organization, which got started in 1947. It's called the Chicago Convention, not, Rob, in honor of your birthday, but that's where it was signed, so that's why it's called the Chicago Convention.
Yeah, in 44, it wasn't even my birthday yet, even for me. It is a really interesting point that John made, though, about the fact that we could well be in violation of the treaty. And I think even more so that the United States has gone out of its way in the last, especially in the last decade, to tell other countries when their aircraft or their airlines are operating unsafely. Indonesia has been a target of that, as have some of the airlines in Africa. And so now the shoe's on the other foot, and everybody's just kind of saying, well, I got to go. And so we thought this week that perhaps the aviation safety inspectors might go back on the job, because here in the United States, the only people that did stay again are air traffic controllers and some of the technicians that are needed to keep the equipment that they use up and operating. But after that, everybody's pretty much gone.
Yeah, and it's probably worth mentioning the reason why we may be in default of the treaty.
That's a good point. What is that, Max?
Well, because among many other things, the treaty has requirements that aircraft comply with applicable safety regulations and that violators are prosecuted. So in the U.S., the FAA implements those requirements through these 3,000 safety inspectors that perform surveillance and oversight. So if you have no inspectors performing surveillance and oversight, then the notion is that, well, maybe then you're in default of the treaty. Another requirement of the treaty is that investigations are conducted for accidents and incidents. And that's what the NTSB does. And so if those folks aren't at work doing those things, then that may be another violation. So it's kind of heavy stuff. But like you say, Rob, in many cases, the United States sort of plays aviation policeman for significant portions of the world. And it's kind of embarrassing now.
I had a chance to hang out with a few NTSB folks this past week at an aviation safety conference in Wichita, and that was thrown by the Bombardier folks. It's called the Aviation Safety Standdown. And so lots of these discussions came up about what's safe, what's not, and the fact that this is really uncharted territory because, of course, in addition to the aviation safety inspectors inspecting things to see if they're safe, there's no one around to give check rides, and not just to people that want private pilot's licenses, because those are usually handled here in the States by FAA-designated examiners. But the professional side, the charter pilot side, captain, first officer, check rides, none of that is getting done either. And so when those people are no longer current, those guys are not going to be flying. And again, but he's quite been, I don't think anybody had thought this through at all, that this was going to be a piece of the deal.
And the implications of this shutdown extends to the military as well. I mean, David, I'm sure you're well aware of some of the things that that had been going on there as a result of the shutdown and the furloughs that were just narrowly avoided.
Well, yeah, everybody went back to work today. In fact, I suddenly got emails today from our favorite author / Army Redstone person, and he knows who he is, Jamie, because I guess he got back to work today. But I do know someone who is currently going through Army UH-60 training, and they split his class up by one half. So half the class is working on Mondays and Wednesdays, and the other classes are working on Tuesdays and Thursdays so they can keep their hours, but it's going to double the time it's going to take for him to get converted to the UH-60. All of the museums that were attached to military bases, like Dover, the Air Mobility Command Museum, was closed all last week and just reopened today. The Air Force Museum in Dayton, Ohio, which is on a military base. We had two special operations missions this week. The basics are there, but you cut back on training, you cut back on support, and it's kind of tough when you close down the PX where all of the families and the soldiers and sailors and airmen and Marines get their food, but anybody to operate the store is furloughed. I mean, that was the kind of things that were occurring because essential personnel and what's a non-essential personnel. Personally, someone who's running the PX, I think, would be essential. So it's been a painful thing for the military like it is for everyone else.
Maybe we should move on to the next one because I'm really getting tired. And the next story just happens to be about pilots that are tired, too. In the Wall Street Journal today, there was an editorial from Chesley Sully Sullenberger and Jim Hall. And, of course, everybody knows who Sully was from the Miracle on the Hudson a few years back. And Jim Hall's the former chairman of the National Transportation Safety Board. And they took the FAA to task, as have quite a few groups tied to the cargo industry, because there is a new set of flight time duty time standards for Part 121, which are the air carrier pilots that come that start, I believe it's in January. And they're going to have to have a little more rest in between shifts. And essentially the result for the air carrier industry is that they're going to probably have to do a little more fancy scheduling to work with the number of pilots they have or perhaps hire more to make it all work. Just one caveat, that cargo pilots were exempt. And even cargo pilots at UPS and FedEx that are flying large aircraft, MD-11s, DC-10s, 747s, Airbuses, I mean, you name it, those large aircraft were all exempt because they were cargo pilots and not carrying passengers. And so folks have not been happy about that on that side of the industry because it makes it look as though the lives of a couple, three, four, five cargo pilots are not worth nearly as much as that of 200 or 300 civilians that might be sitting in the back of a traditional airliner. So, but I've always wondered, what do you guys think about that? Is that does that seem like a smart idea to place that kind of value on the lives of cargo pilots?
You know, I'm trying to think in my head what the logic might be for excluding cargo flights, and I can't think of any. I mean, if you're only looking at this from a standpoint of the safety of the passengers, okay, that could be a conclusion, but that can't be it. I mean, I can't believe that the pilots don't count. I just don't know what the logic is for excluding cargo flights.
It's money, at least from what I have learned over the past couple of years, because it will indeed cost these organizations money in terms of additional aircraft and or additional crews to make these schedules work, because there's going to have to be more time involved in them now in terms of how many pilots you may need to fill out a day. And they just simply said the return on investment just didn't seem to indicate that the cargo folks were worth it. And I have a couple of friends that fly for UPS and FedEx, and they were not happy about that whole thing.
I bet.
So, and I think that's essentially what Sully and Jim Hall said, is that give me a break. The guys in the UPS Airbus that crashed at Birmingham a few weeks ago will not be covered by the increase in rest time that their brethren flying the same aircraft would be if they had passengers. And so their point was that if the thing crashes into a populated area, it's going to be just as big a mess as if it had been filled with passengers and not boxes.
Hmm. And it doesn't seem to me like it would put any one of the cargo carriers at a competitive disadvantage, right? I mean, this is something that would affect all of them. So their competitors would see the same increased costs. And then if the entire, you know, cargo industry does, then that just gets passed along to the consumer, which is fine. That's the way these things work. And no one's left at a disadvantage. So,
well, no, you wouldn't think so. And of course, as Peter Johnson mentioned when he sent us a note here this past week, it's not just us here in the United States that are dealing with this, but it's a big issue in the European Union as well. About the changes to flight and duty times over there. There was a vote last week in which one of the transport committees turned back some of the flight and duty time suggestions that had been made, and there's another vote coming up, I believe it is this coming week, to decide what they're going to do in Europe. So this is a very, very big deal all over the world because, again, the longer the rest times that are added to any of these schedules, the more rest and hence more the greater the number of pilots it's going to take to make it all work, which is financially a burden to the air carriers, or at least that's what they say. So we'll have to see what happens with that one. This next story that we have from Garmin, I don't know if you guys had a chance to do your research prior to the show and take a look at this cool watch that is the first GPS watch for aviators. Maybe one of you can explain one thing to me after I looked at that. How do you tell the time with that thing?
Yeah, no, it's a pretty cool looking watch. It looks pretty high tech. It sounds pretty high tech, but when you look at it, I don't see where the hands are. I don't see where the time is. I'm sure it's there.
Oh, I'm hoping it is too, because we'll put a photo of this up on the show notes so you can take a look at it. And this watch has a built-in GPS. It has a great altimeter that can be adjusted to the local barometric pressure. It has a horizontal situation indicator, for those of you that are familiar with that, and also a moving map. And the only thing it doesn't do is tell time, but I might be wrong somewhere.
And maybe I've got a question for all of you pilots in the audience.
Okay.
Haven't we worked really hard to keep your heads out of the cockpit and into the windscreen in front of you?
Yes.
That you would be looking at your watch while flying?
I must admit, I love the folks at Garmin. They come up with some pretty cool technology. However, trying to fly the airplane with using a horizontal situation indicator, which makes essentially a VOR or an ILS signal a little easier to understand. Trying to fly the airplane by looking at my wrist, I don't know. I have a problem with that. I can't quite figure out how it's going to run, but maybe we'll have to get the people from Garmin on to explain how we tell time with this.
Hey, Randy, what's your opinion on the subject?
Well, of course, all pilots like gadgets, so you can't go wrong there. And I think just as important to most pilots is how cool it looks. And it does look pretty cool, and you can't explain that it's a special aviation watch, so it's got that going for it. The only other thing you can say in its defense is redundancy. When everything else goes wrong, you got your watch to fall back on. I think it was Carpenter, one of the original seven Mercury astronauts. When everything else went down, he got by with a grease pencil on his windshield and a hack from his watch. So it is nice to have backup. So
now, Rob, this thing is called the D2, is that right?
Correct.
Where did you find this? I searched around for this Garmin D2 GPS watch and I came up really dry. Has this been announced?
Actually, it won't be announced until Wednesday, which is the day that this airs. And I think it is possibly tied to the AOPA's summit that begins this week in the Fort Worth area.
In my backyard.
That's right. And it's the last summit because they're going to AOPA is going to be moving to that more regional show format. And so I may be out to lunch on this, but I just kind of assumed they were holding on to it till that day for the AOPA convention. But however, I should tell everyone, in case my wife is listening, I could have one of these for Christmas. This would be nice.
I bet this is not going to be inexpensive.
You know, they didn't talk about the price, surprisingly. Huh? Go figure, huh? Yeah.
And as my mother, God rest her soul, used to say, if you have to ask, you can't afford it.
Yeah, that's a good point. So, well, you know, it has been an interesting week. And as I mentioned briefly before, Randy, our guest, and I happened to catch up at the Bombardier safety stand down in Wichita this week, and that entire program is all safety all week. And if you're a safety geek like I am, there was not anything on there that was that was boring. I mean, and so we had lots of chances to talk with a lot of people in the industry about how to improve safety in aircraft of all sizes, shapes, and colors. And again, it's something that Bombardier throws every year. It started out as a piece of essentially internal training for their Learjet crews down there in Wichita, and it just grew and grew and grew. And from the folks at Bombardier the other day, they told me they had representatives from 297 companies and almost 500 people down there that were safety geeks. And the best part is Bombardier does not charge for the safety standout. You can attend all of, I mean, if you can get in, they tend to have a waiting list. But it's primarily for business and commercial aviation geeks. And certainly there are military folks there as well. But it tends not to be the show that people that are just, you know, flying 172s or Archers or that sort of thing tend to attend. Although many of the lessons we saw on the big airplanes are applicable to what goes on the smaller airplanes. So and again, next year it'll be back in Wichita in the end of September, I believe. So it's something to look forward to. All right. So, Randy, are you all set?
I am.
Cool.
Let me start by giving my thanks to Bombardier, because just to weigh in on what Rob said, it's great to see a company. Obviously, Bombardier gets some visibility out of what they're doing, but I think that they're very proud of the fact that they're actually providing a good service, and they don't care that the people that come are flying Cessna aircraft or Boeings or Gulfstreams or anything. They just have put together a solid group of information and presenters. I had been hearing about that event for many years. This was my first opportunity to go as a presenter for APS, and I think I learned as much as all of the people there attending. So it was just nice to see a company like Bombardier, who certainly has other things that they could be doing, spending the amount of time and effort. And it, you know, as you might imagine, it takes quite a lot to put on an event like that. So it was nice to see.
And that sort of thing is unusual in my mind, especially these days, because when a company is looking to cut costs and to manage their budgets, one of the first things to go is events like this, things that benefit other people more than just the, you know, the core company. So I think that says a lot about Bombardier, the company.
Well, I think that one of the things that they've learned is that doing the right thing pays, because one of the things that they branched out on this year is that Bombardier Safety Stand Down has become a brand in and of itself. Mm. And they are now going to be marketing some of the services that they have offered through their Bombardier Leading Edge program to other people at large. And it's not like they're doing that because there's a large margin in it, but because they have had interest from people other than their own customers, people flying their own aircraft. And so, if anything, it's expanding.
That's true. And you know, David, I was going to ask you, before I read this cool bio from our guest, could you tell people what a stand down is? Because it came from the military, I believe, right?
Well, you stand down, meaning that you stop doing everything. It's a military term per se, but when you have a stand down, you stop everything and you proceed to look at all your processes. A lot of times, stand downs can be negative, but in this case, they're putting it in a positive. If you have a base commander and they come aboard the base and they tell you we're stood down due to phalanx operations or something, that's usually not a good thing. That means it was a serious crisis that they found and they have to stop everything to fix it, find it, locate it, and then correct it. But in this case, it's a more positive thing where you're taking the time to breathe and think through the processes and reviewing it. So it's taking a negative and making it positive.
In fact, Gene Cernan, who is the last man to walk on the moon, who is there and has been at the safety stand down almost since its inception, and they now have an award that they offer annually in his name, made exactly the point that David just did, which is that this is a preemptive stand down. It's not coming after an accident that causes everybody to do that self-analysis that David was talking about. It is something that we can do ahead of time to try and get ahead of the curve.
Yeah, it's a good point. And, you know, I'm sorry, I cannot take another moment without giving our listeners your bio, Randy, because, I mean, I'm not usually the one that reads the bios, but, I mean, you have such a cool life that I just feel like I have to give people the reason that we're talking to you tonight. And so I feel like I'm going to say, Randy Brooks, this is your life. But I won't go quite that far. But let me just tell our listeners a little bit about you. The fact that you were born at Edwards Air Force Base, and you're the son of an Air Force test pilot yourself, and that you've been close to flying, and you've logged over 12,500 hours in 100 different airplanes and jets and turboprops, and that you've started flying gliders in high school. And you received a BS in aerospace engineering from the University of Colorado in Boulder, which I bet you're glad you weren't there a couple of weeks ago with all the rain, I bet, huh?
Yes, I have friends that were, though, and fortunately they all were okay, but yes.
Crazy place. But, of course, and like a lot of us, you gained some of your time as a flight instructor teaching aerobatics, and I think that's something I've never wanted to do, which was teach aerobatics. So my hat is off to you. But I think it really got interesting for you there in 84 when you started on the professional air pilot, or I'm sorry, the professional air show pilot circuit. And this bio says you did 500 formation aerobatic demonstrations.
It was over 550. And yes, it was kind of like running off to join the circus, except that in my case, it was running off to join the flying circus. So, yeah.
Wow. But as David and I were talking about earlier today, another aspect of your life was that in 2001, you became the director of operations for the Red Baron Squadron, the formation aerobatic team with those big steerman biplanes that so many of us hear growling around at the air shows. And I just love that part. And the pizza. I mean, did you get free pizza when you worked there?
All we could eat. Unfortunately, it was good pizza, but that was the team that I joined in 1984, really at the beginning. I flew the first air show that Red Baron flew, which was interesting in that we didn't exactly have permission to perform that air show, nor insurance or anything like that, but, you know, ask for forgiveness rather than permission. But the company did kind of like what they saw, and so the team continued performing air shows for over 25 years. But I had sort of three different tours, if you will, with the Red Baron Squadron, because I left that team to fly on another team of Pitt Specials, a four-ship team that was sponsored by Holiday Inns, later Holiday Inns and Coca-Cola, for a period of about 6 years. And then came back to the Red Baron Squadron for a second time with the idea of moving laterally over to their corporate flight department. I was the only person to sort of make that switch.
because I had picked up my ATP when I was off flying pizzas by getting some twin time in the Navajo support plane that we flew. And then I flew the whole King Air series through the Citation 5, was the jet that the company had. And then in 2001, they had some management changes and asked if I would be interested in applying to be the director of operations for the squadron, which sounded like a good opportunity because for several years, both as a Red Baron pilot and later as a corporate pilot, I was able to straddle the fence a little bit, and so that literally one day I would be flying a Citation 5 around, and the next day I would be flying formation aerobatics and a steerman. So I at all points in my professional career, I have never taken it for granted. But there were some moments like that where I knew I was getting kind of a unique opportunity.
Wow, that is really that's really interesting. And now, of course, too, we'll find that you did join the Eclipse Aviation Group there in 2005 and became their manager of emergency situation training, because the Eclipse folks, the twin engine light, very light jets, had a plan to make sure that everybody had some upset and recovery training prior to taking command of the airplane. But I think that's probably the interesting direction you took to join up with the APS folks in 2012, and you became their vice president of training and business development. And my gosh, I mean, the rest is kind of history there. But I think something that I'm curious about when you joined Aviation Performance Solutions, the question I'm always wondering about is, why has upset prevention and recovery training become such a big deal over the last few years? Because most of us never really heard about a whole lot of it before.
That's right, because statistically, controlled flight into terrain was the biggest problem that we had in aviation through the 90s, and that was the biggest killer. And because of that, we came out with GPWIS, Ground Proximity Warning System, and TAWS, Terrain Warning Awareness Warning System, and also now we have synthetic vision, you know, and better display technology. We're all a lot less likely to fly into the side of a mountain that we can see depicted. And so because of that, CFIT, Controlled Flight into Terrain, really was beaten into submission. We tackled it largely through technology. But unfortunately, loss of control in flight then became the predominant cause of fatalities, not because there wasn't a technological silver bullet to take care of that, because it's really a pilot-centered problem. It needed to be taken care of by training. So it was that awareness, that growing awareness, that this was the biggest threat in aviation that led a lot of different people to try and tackle it. I became aware of the problem back in the mid-90s, and so the art, if you will, the science of upset prevention and recovery training, initially called emergency maneuver training, upset recovery training, sort of coalesced around what were basic aerobatic skills at one time. But we got smarter and smarter about how to apply those aerobatic skills specifically to attacking the upset problem. And what really is fascinating about the subject for me is that we are still learning on a very, very rapid basis. If I can take us back to, 2009 was the Air France 447 accident that that went in between Brazil and France. And although we did not know it at the time, what is interesting is that the day after that accident, there was a convention convened in London at the Royal Aeronautical Society to address loss of control in flight, to try and focus on this problem and what could be done with it. Now, what they determined at that conference was that this was not a small enough problem that a conference could tackle. It was something that required a standing committee. And so the International Committee
for Aviation Training and Extended Envelopes, ICATE, was formed, and that long name refers to the extended envelopes of flight simulators, since that is how we train most of our professional pilots at this time. And so it was an outgrowth of the flight simulation group within Royal Aeronautical Society, and they figured, well, we train pilots in simulators, we've got to make better simulators. Well, when we started to really dig into the problem, we realized that part of the problem could be solved through better simulators, but that part of it had to involve the use of an aircraft. And the interesting thing is, once again, it's not technological. In this case, it's psychological or psychophysiological, because unless you are doing training with the presence, the perception of risk, or the threat of consequences, then the brain is not working on the same circuit that we're operating on right now. We're using our frontal lobes as we talk about this and think clearly. But in the presence of a lot of stress, we all go to our caveman brains. We don't get smarter. In fact, we all become cognitively impaired. And so this is not a subject that we can tackle just through academics, just by reading about it. If so, we would write the book and we would give it all the pilots and we would be done with it. It's a little trickier than that. And a simulator, no matter how good the simulator is, and those of you that have had to go through check rides have gotten out of the box with a sweaty back before, and you might have even scared yourself a little bit with some of the things that you might have seen in there. In the end, you knew that you had six legs bolted to the floor and that you were not going to get hurt unless it fell off the motion or something like that. So that's where the aircraft comes in. Although, in using the aircraft, we can use a variety of different methods to mitigate the threat of all attitude maneuvering and give the pilot the same eye-opening experience that is necessary, so that if they get in an upset in real life, it's not the first time that they have seen that situation, and they're going to be able to safely and effectively recover the aircraft in a manner which they have been taught.
Well, and you know, that I think that's it's a very interesting point that you make. And so what we have also learned, in fact, I learned that from some of you guys when I had a chance to visit the APS facilities in at Mesa Airport there in Phoenix last year, just sitting down with my instructor, who was Otter. Oh, in fact, you know what? Everybody has a call sign there. Randy, what's your call sign at APS?
I go by Randy Randall, or Random is my call sign. And that's because perhaps my behavior was a little bit less predictable in my youth. So Random, it's...
So Random. Okay. Well, Random, I didn't fly with you, but I did fly with Otter. And what I thought was interesting is that we sat down and did some in-depth discussions of aerobatics. And I'm sorry, not aerobatics, of aerodynamics that apply to aircraft at high altitudes, which is really where we've been seeing some of these loss of control issues occur in areas that we never trained people in before. And it's amazing how, when we got into some of the depths of it, I realized that there were things that I've done over the years that I just did, but that I honestly couldn't explain with the kind of depth that that Otter brought to the discussions. And I realized, I'll bet you there are probably an awful lot of people flying high-performance aircraft up high that have a minimal amount of understanding of what really occurs in some of those thin air regimes up there, where the power is you're almost out of power, and the angle of attack is high, and it's a lot more frightening once you almost understand the aerodynamics behind it. But then, of course, you're much more aware. And so I think that also goes hand in hand with the flying that you're doing. But I think something that people might wonder is that if you're talking about making pilots of 747s safer up high, I mean, how does flying around in an extra, which is a little single engine aerobatic tail dragger airplane, how does that translate from one airplane to the other?
I promise I'll answer that question, but I'm going to answer another question that you didn't ask first, because I pointed out that academics in and of itself can't solve the problem. But at the same time, you bring up a very good point with regard to the high-speed and high-altitude aerodynamics that we cover. And that is essential, too, because as you said, that builds the basis of awareness. And the reason that I wanted to bring that up is that a lot of people are confused about the distinction between upset prevention and recovery training and aerobatics. Everybody understands aerobatics. I've seen an air show, seen people maneuvering on TV, but when I was teaching aerobatics, which I did for many years, I was not interested in tackling any more academics, and neither was the student, than was required to get them through a loop or a hammerhead correctly. But in the case of upset prevention and recovery training, that academics is the foundation for the handling skills and other things that will be introduced. So the reason I needed to answer that first, Rob, is because that is also lays the foundation to why a light aircraft be used, because there are certain aerodynamic principles that apply to all fixed-wing aircraft. It doesn't matter if they're straight-wing or swept-wing or prop or jet. Some of these aerodynamic characteristics apply across the board, and if the crew of Air France 447 or some other accidents where we've seen pilots being confused about the fact that the aircraft is stalled are introduced in the right way, showing people the four characteristics of a stall that are present in all fixed-wing aircraft, then it doesn't matter if there's a stall warning or not. People are going to add things up and say, hey, do I have buffeting? Hey, do I have a lack of elevator authority? Do I have lateral instability? Do I have an inability to arrest my rate of descent? Hey, I must be stalled. I was taught that. Even though I was taught that in a light aerobatic airplane, I'm experiencing that in this large transport category aircraft, I know what the problem is, and I know that the solution is to reduce the angle of attack. That's just one example of the aerodynamic lessons that are introduced in the classroom and then brought to life in the aircraft, which is essentially used as a laboratory for the academics that we provide pilots before we ever go out and fly. So that's how you can transfer. The second point is that we have to focus the use of the light aircraft, the all-attitude, all-envelope capable aircraft, on those lessons that are applicable. For instance, I do the takeoffs and the landings in the extra 300 L that we use because that's not what our students are there to learn to do. They are there to learn what 2.5 G's feels like, because transport category aircraft are certified to 2.5 G's, and we can teach them pretty reliably within a tenth of a G. They can identify how much they're pulling by the time they're done with training with us. So that's a physiological feeling that transfers to any aircraft that you might fly. So that's how you have to do it. You have to do it through a course and through instructors that are able to focus on those transferable skills and introduce them in a way that will make sense to other aircraft that they might fly later on, not just in the particular surrogate aircraft that's being used for training.
Well, now, you know, we had a couple of dropouts on Skype there a little earlier, and I just wanted to get something clear that I think you explained that we may not have heard. So can you tell me what the difference is between upset prevention recovery training and aerobatics?
Yes. First of all, everybody is aware of aerobatics. It's doing loops and rolls and other maneuvers. And the best way to look at it is that aerobatics is precision maneuvering with a known outcome. Upset prevention and recovery training is non-precision maneuvering to correct an unknown condition. So another way of looking at it is UPRT is applied to aerobatics. We certainly are maneuvering the airplane in three dimensions in an all-attitude and all-envelope way, the way we do in aerobatics, but we're only using that subset of aerobatics which is helpful to us solving the upset problem that we might be facing.
Well, tell me this now. How long has APS been in business?
17 years now.
17 years, and how many pilots have been through the upset prevention recovery training?
It's well over 5,000, but we're accelerating. We expect to train over 1,000 pilots. Well, we did this year. We had a little slow time during the summer, but we are the largest service UPRT provider in the world. And the importance of that is that because of the volume of training, the number of pilots that we put through, we tend to see things just through the number of pilots that we work with and compiling information. We've also reached a point now where we have a significant number of standing instructors, full-time instructors on staff, and the cross-pollination of ideas. These are all smart guys. You know, we have test pilot school grads, we have fighter weapons school instructors, we have people that have flown for commercial airlines and a variety of different aircraft. So it's really one of those environments where it's fast. Your coworkers are fascinating because of the work that we do together to try and bring up this field and make ourselves better at what we do.
Randy, can I ask, what's the makeup of the APS students? Are they mostly commercial pilots?
They are normally mostly business and commercial aviation pilots. I mentioned earlier we have a relationship with Bombardier Leading Edge, where we have two seats in training that are provided to every buyer of a Learjet, Challenger, or Global aircraft comes to train with us. Another large group that we have are ab initio students. We are also the exclusive UPRT provider for CAE. CAE has their Oxford Global Academy located in Phoenix, and we train about 200 of their cadets a year. They come to us with about 100 hours between their instrument training and their multi-engine training. And then the third large group, if you will, are government and military pilots, whether it's from the U.S. Forest Service, Border Protection, or the U.S. Army. We have a great number of them that are coming to us. And what's really fascinating as an instructor is I can be flying with a 100-hour pilot who's learning to fly in the morning, and then I can fly with a Learjet pilot, and I can end up flying with a warrant officer in the Army that's flying King Airs or Dash 7s all over the world. And so with each of those students, I have to mentally put myself in their aircraft. So I have to think like I'm flying a Piper, a Learjet, or a King Air or other aircraft while I'm working with those students.
And I think one of the interesting aspects of it is that when I did my my mini lesson out there last year, I came back with Otter, and we shut down, and he opened the canopy and said, "So what did you think?" And I just went, "Whoa." Because it was so eye-opening, and to take a really cocky, you know, corporate pilot and put him in an airplane like that and show him some stuff that makes him realize that he ain't near as smart as he thinks he was, and not in a bad way. I meant in a good way, certainly. It was very eye-opening, and that's why I particularly like what you guys are doing with CAE's group of new hires, essentially, the ab initio people, because it sounds to me like you're also giving them that that in-depth aerodynamic discussion, or holding those discussions that most of us probably never had years ago. Would that be a fair statement?
Absolutely. And the beauty of providing it to them at that point in their careers is that safety benefit of awareness that they're going to get at that early stage in their flying is going to carry with them through the rest of their experience as a pilot, no matter what they fly. But I'd like to talk a little bit about that introductory experience that you have, because in your case, we were kind of condensing things to show you, give you a snapshot, a synopsis of the entire program. It's a little bit more subdued when we have somebody that's going through a four-flight profile program with us. We try and be very gentle because, unfortunately, the experience that a lot of people have had with aerobatics is some knucklehead that they know with a Pitts or another aerobatic airplane that wants to take them up and scare them or make them sick. And that is not at all what we're about. When we get done, we want the pilots that we fly with to understand that we can approach the flying
the all-attitude flying that we do in every bit as a professional manner as they approach all of their flights with passengers in the aircraft, the transport category aircraft that they fly.
And I think that's really interesting that you mentioned the way the mini sessions were organized, because the day that I was out there, we had two other journalists. We had Fred George from Business and Commercial Aviation with us, who, of course, is an old fighter pilot. So none of that stuff really bothered him. But Pia Berquist from Flying Magazine was in there with me as well. And so we really had a wide range of experiences. And I think every one of us, even Fred, who is, you know, highly experienced at this, came away realizing that there was always more to learn. And I think that's one of the really, really strong parts of what you guys do. And I mean, do you ever have people, though, that finish the training that say, I don't know, it didn't really do much for me?
No, I have to tell you that I have not had that experience. And I had the pleasure of flying with both Pia and Fred. And as you say, they come from opposite or different ends of the spectrum in terms of their experience. But to a person, and let's see, I'm keeping track, and I'm over 190 pilots that I've flown with while I've been at APS. I have never had anybody that has flown with us that has not said that they learned something. And the interesting thing is, you know, I had been teaching aerobatics for 20 years and had a degree in engineering, and I learned stuff as an instructor that I had never come across.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Well, one last issue I would like to raise is, do you think that this kind of training is something we're going to see being required by the regulatory bodies one of these days?
Well, yes. People in the United States might be familiar with a new requirement that's coming out in August of next year called the Airline Transport Pilot Certification Training Program. And before pilots can take a written test for their ATP, they are going to be required to take a course of instruction that's not required now. And in both the academic and the simulator portion of that certification test program is upset prevention and recovery training. Another issue that's coming down the road through ICAO, which we mentioned earlier, is a recommendation on the part of ICAO that all commercial pilots, that is commercially licensed pilots, when they receive their commercial rating, should receive upset prevention recovery training in actual flight, is the way it is worded, which means in an airplane. And so that is supposed to go into effect in November of 2014. So it might take a while for the national aviation authorities like the FAA and EASA to put that in place. But I think that there will be a day where it will be a core competency of every airline pilot to have gone through this training at some point during their career.
Sounds like a good idea to me. Well, Randy, anything else you might want to talk to us about in terms of upset and prevention that we didn't touch on already?
Yes, there is one other training platform that we didn't mention, in addition to the extras that we fly, the academics that we do, the simulators that we use of CAEs, which is that we have an A4 in our stable now that Otter, your instructor, flies for us, and another instructor. And that can provide people with some of the high-altitude aerodynamics in real flight, getting up there into the 30s, where some of the effects of compressibility can actually be experienced in flight, and we think that's an exciting addition to APS's capabilities.
So you mean that you're going to have students that would be taking an A4 Skyhawk up into the high altitude range, and are they doing stalls or just steep turns, or what are they doing up there?
This is not in the future. We are already doing this, and yes, they are doing stalls and they are doing steep turns, and they're seeing a variety of aerodynamic effects. They're seeing the amount of altitude that's lost in recovering from a stall up at those altitudes versus recovering at lower altitudes where there's plenty of excess thrust and thicker air.
Wow, it's really incredible. Well, I think that's really going to be something we're going to have to follow. So, Randy, I would like to really thank you for joining us tonight as the representative from APS, and I hope that we have a chance to have you or one of the other guys, Otter or BJ or somebody, on again at another time. And just tell our listeners, though, where they can go if they want to get some more information about APS.
We're on the web at apstraining.com. There is a significant amount of information about the company on there, including what you should look for in trying to select a training provider. All of our pricing information is on there, but we welcome you, your listeners, to give us a call if they have any questions, but there's a large amount of information that I think they'll enjoy looking at on that site.
Not to mention some great videos of some of the training because you have cameras inside all the airplanes.
We think that that's an important way to not only give our clients something that they can take home with them, but it's an important training tool because they can look at those videos of their training 6 months or a year later and remember some of the feedback that they were given in flight to help provide a little bit of staying power to the training that they got with us.
Yeah, I think that's really great. Well, again, thank you so much for joining us. And we'll be talking to you more about upset prevention and recovery training as time goes on.
I've got a quick question for Randy. You know, if you go back 5 years and 4 months ago to episode one of the Airplane Geeks podcast, and you look at the photo that's associated with the post for that episode one, it was the Eclipse, the little single engine Eclipse jet. That was our first photo on our first episode. And you flew that into Oshkosh, didn't you?
There are only three pilots in the world that flew that airplane as pilot in command, and you're talking to one of them, and the only one that got to fly aerobatics in it at Oshkosh.
How did it fly?
Well, it was a prototype. It was a little rough inside. It helped that my early aerobatics were done in gliders because basically it was a powered glider. It had one of the engines off of the Eclipse 500, which was only 900 pounds of thrust, and in production it would have had 50% more thrust, and I only had a five-minute routine. So it was really the culmination of all of my corporate upset and aerobatic experience all together to create the training program, execute it, and display the aircraft. And it was really an honor to have a company give me the reins to a unique aircraft like that and let me display it for them.
And sort of an associated question, and I don't know if you're able to answer this or not, but we've had a listener that's been asking us about how does insurance work for test pilots.
I saw that, and I am afraid that I can't. I thought it was an interesting question, and of course, the Air Force has all of that covered, or the military, but in the civilian world, I know that there are bonuses, premiums that are paid for first flights or for more challenging or risky flights, but I don't know exactly what the insurance situation is, although I am quite confident that it is spoken for some in one way or another.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
I think it sounds like it's time to move on to David's segment. And David, as I understand it, this week you don't have an airplane for us to talk about, and you have a stand-in.
2 weeks ago, I said that I'm going away next week, so I won't be here. So I wanted someone to write a history segment because Lord knows we can't go without a history segment. We actually got a couple of early entries, and I thought, you know what? Why don't I milk it for what it's worth, and I'll take 2 weeks off. So tonight's episode is brought to you by Tom Brueshaver, and I get the impression he's more than familiar with the aircraft he wrote about. His email definitely references the airplane he loves. So the Airplane Geek's airplane of the week is the Cozy Mark IV. In 1975, Bert Rutan showed up at Oshkosh in a new airplane. The airplane was the Very Easy. It wasn't the first composite aircraft available to the amateur builder, but it turned out to be one of the most popular. The Very Easy is a two-seat single canard aircraft. The two seats are in tandem configuration with a pilot in the front and passenger in the back. Most Very Easies have no controls in the back. The Very Easy was built using techniques called moldless composites. The composites allow the aircraft to be very light and very strong. Being moldless, the home builder didn't need any special jigs or tooling. Canard, French for duck, aircraft have the main wing in the rear and the smaller control surface canard in the front. The idea is the smaller control surface will be more wing-loaded, so it will stall before the main wing. With the smaller wing stalled, the main wing will be less likely to stall, making the aircraft safer to fly. Unlike conventional aircraft, the canard is a lifting surface, allowing the main wing to lift some and the canard to lift the rest of the aircraft. Within a few months of flying into Oshkosh, Bert had plans available for the Very Easy. The plans were popular in many ways, caused a real shakeup in airplane building. The composite home building revolution had begun. One of the buyers of the Very Easy was an engineer from St. Paul, Minnesota, named Nathan Nat Puffer. Nat would quickly build his Very Easy and was flying it to fly-ins all over. Nat would typically fly with his wife Shirley in the back. At these fly-ins, Nat would get many questions about the aircraft and was able to see that the idea was a good one. Nat flew to Mojave to meet Bert, and Bert offered Nat a job. Nat turned Bert's job offer down, but they kept in touch. I still want to know who the heck turns down Bert Rattan when they offer you a job. Shirley didn't like flying in the backseat of Nate's Very Easy. She wanted a different airplane so that she could sit in front. Nat sketched out a wider Very Easy that could hold two people in the front seat, but still only one person in the rear. Nat asked Bert if he would give his blessings on the altered design. Bert didn't want to do it, but thought it was a plausible idea. Bert had just come out with a larger airplane, the Long Easy. The Long Easy was also a single-engine, two-seat canard aircraft using the modeless composites, but it retained the tandem seating. The Long Easy had facilities for a larger engine and improved control. Nat looked at the Long Easy plans and thought they would be a better start for building the three-seat airplane. The Long Easy has a simpler wing attachment and is able to handle larger engines. The larger engines would allow changes if the Lycoming O-235 wasn't powerful enough. Nat finished his aircraft in 1981 and flew it to Oshkosh in the following year. There was a significant interest in the three-seat Long Easy, and Nat and Bert came to an agreement about Nat selling it a set of plans for the Cozy 3 based on the Long Easy plans in 1984. The unique thing about most Rattan design canards is only the nose gear retracts. The main gear is fixed. With the heavy engine in the rear of the main gear and no one in the aircraft, they tend to tip on their backs. Bert's solution was to retract the nose gear on the ground while moving the center of the gravity forward, thus making the aircraft very stable in a grazing, quote-unquote, position. The Cozy aircraft retained this feature. After a few years, Nat was approached by Uli Walter, a German builder, about selling the plans for the Cozy in Europe. Nat allowed Uli to sell plans in Europe to the Cozy Classic. Uli called his company Cozy Europe. In 1986, Nat saw another place where he could build an airplane. Nat decided to build a four-place version of the Long Easy, or Cozy. The aircraft would be significantly larger and built to hold the Lycoming O320, or larger engine. The aircraft he built first flew in 1988 and Oshkosh the following year. There was significant interest in the larger aircraft, and Nat put together plans for the Cozy Mark IV. The following year, Nat had built a proof of plans aircraft and began selling the plans. Nate's agreement with Bert allowed Nate to sell plans for this aircraft also. The Cozy Mark IV is a true four-seat aircraft capable of holding four people who get along and can fly at 200 miles an hour. Most Cozy Mark IVs are built with the Lycoming 0360 or IO360 four-cylinder 180 to 200 horsepower engines, although some are fitted with the O320 and perform well. Generally, the Cozies have fixed pitch propellers, but several have been built with constant speed propellers, offering even more performance. The Cozy Mark IV uses many of the templates of the Long Easy, but has beefed up fittings, landing gear, and longer wings, 28 feet 1.5 inches versus 26 feet 1 inch. It's relatively easy for Nat to get to the outside fabricators to build modified Long Easy parts to be used with the Cody. Nat had successfully done testing on his Cozy Mark IV to be sure it wouldn't enter a deep stall that some other canard aircrafts were getting stuck in. The lock deep stall was prevalent in some canard aircraft that were flown with the CT center of gravity too far aft, allowing the canard to be lightly loaded and less prone to stalling. Sometimes the canard and the main wing would stall about the same time. Nat wanted to find the CG limit where the main wing wouldn't be able to stall. After many tests with his proof of plans aircraft, he was able to find the limit and set the center of gravity limit accordingly. Cozy aircraft have been modified to hold larger people and have been built with larger engines, up to the Lycoming IO-540. There is a Cozy jet, a twin-engine Cozy, a Suzuki three-cylinder engines in the place where an O-360 would normally fit. There are retractable gear Cozies even when where the main gear retract. And the Cozy is even being larger and generally faster than the Longies with similar engines. Nat has sold all of his rights to the Cozy Mark IV to Aircraft Spruce. Several plans a month are sold to the aircraft, and both Aircraft Spruce and Wix Aircraft sell chapter kits that can make the building very easy. Build times for some novice builders range from 18 months to 18 years. There's an extensive builder support network for the Cozy Mark IV, starting with the website cozybuilders.org. And all the builders connected there. Several aircraft are finished each year, and there are currently over 200 Cozy aircraft registered in the United States and several in other countries, including Australia, France, and Germany. So that about does it, folks. The airplane of the week, the Cozy Mark IV. And I did some snooping around, and on the cozybuilders.org page happens to be pictures of Tom's aircraft. Each builder on that website puts up a picture of their completed kit. So I really want to thank Tom for doing this. It wouldn't have been an aircraft that I would have picked first and foremost, but even Rob knows that I like Burt Rutan aircraft ever since I was reading Air Progresses in the late 70s and early 80s. So again, Tom, excellent job. And now that I've done it, if I ever meet you in Oshkosh, can I go for a ride? And this is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off, and I'll see you in 2 weeks.
Nicely done, David. Wow. And I think the name Cozy is certainly interesting, and you mentioned the most impressive point that, what did you say, the four people have to like each other?
I didn't, Tom did, but I like the part where even larger air people can fit in it. It's still a tight airframe.
Yes, and not only do they have to like each other, but it would be nice if they had bathed recently before a long flight. That's a good thing to have as well. So, but that's pretty neat. So did that work out the way that you thought it would, having a guest historian in, David?
Oh, absolutely. We did get a couple other ones, but I'm expecting a flood of more. And I like this kind of being able to take off a day or so every so often without having to write a history segment. So, but excellent job, Tom. And for our first one, it was really well done. Thank you very much.
We'll have to send him some Airplane Geeks buttons. Of course, we'll have to make sure we get some to the guys at APS as well. And it sounds, Max, like it's time to move on to the guys who live in the land of the koalas, don't you think?
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Ahoy there, shiver me timbers, me old mateys. The dateline today, it'd be 6th of October 2013. And how you be doing, Steve, me old salt?
Unbelievable, mate. And last week you were picking on me about talking about the football, and here you are trying to go all nautical. What's the meaning of this? And what's the meaning of that awful village people music running underneath this?
Well, I don't know. You're the one who selected the music,
mate. Oh, yeah.
I'll tell you what. Mate, it's been an incredible couple of weeks with the International Fleet Review just kicking off over the weekend that we've just finished. As we were mentioning previously, a couple of weeks ago, I got to visit the HMS Daring, a very advanced stealth ship, apparently, is what they're calling it. But it's also the air warfare ship of the future, of the British Navy, with an amazing anti-aircraft, anti-skimming missile defense system that actually gives the American Aegis system a bit of a run for its money. Then Kathy got to do her media flight on a Taipan and go down and record some interviews with some of the Australians down at Jervis Bay, getting ready for the review. And mate, I was actually up there on Friday, up in Sydney, and scored some interviews with the crew of a New Zealand Sea Sprite helicopter on one of their Anzac frigates, and then got to watch the mass flyby and a few other things that went on in the morning on Saturday as the fleet sailed into the harbour.
Fantastic, mate. And I didn't have the opportunity to get up there to Sydney to witness that. that, but although it was obviously a naval review and celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Royal Australian Navy first sailing into Sydney Harbour as the Royal Australian Navy kicked off, taking over responsibility, I guess, from the British way back at that time. And boy, have we had some ships from navies all around the world here, but certainly from an aerial standpoint, there was aircraft of all descriptions flying over Sydney. It must have looked rather spectacular.
Oh, mate, as you might expect, there were lots of helicopters, a few sightseeing ones making use of the helicopter corridor out through the harbour till they closed that down for the main ceremonies to take place. We had His Royal Highness Prince Harry plus our Governor General were on board HMAS Leeuwin. They took the ship out in position near the Opera House, and a couple of long columns of ships came in through the heads and around the harbour and up and past the Leeuwin for the royal salute. And during that process, we had a number of aircraft do formation flybys up the harbour. We had some Hornets and Hawks do a formation flypast. There was the Wedgetail. There were a collection of P-3 Orions, both Australian, Pakistani, and also a Kiwi one in there. The formation of three Australian P-3s was a nice little echelon formation. Then we had, I believe it was the Pakistani one, followed by the Kiwis. And then there was a whole lot of helicopters came through. I was waiting to hear Ride of the Valkyries. I tell you, it was a bunch of Seahawks and then a whole lot of Taipans and Squirrels and some Kiowas, the jet rangers, and also some of the foreign helicopters were in. There was an American Seahawk and also the Lynx that I had been interviewing the pilot for back with the HMS Daring. And lots of helicopters in the air, lots to be seen, but unfortunately I had to bug out where we were and come back to Melbourne, so I got to see the F-18 handling demo on the tiny screen in the seat in front of me on my Virgin aircraft as we waited to push back and head out.
Fantastic. And I should mention too, Grant, of all the navies that were here, for our American listeners, the USS Chosen was here. Yes. As part of the festivities. And boy, I tell you what, I would love to have been up there. And Sydney certainly turned on some great weather, which is fantastic. I can't even pick on Sydney weather this time. So well done, Sydney. Fantastic job. Now, Grant, just as an aside, you said you flew Virgin, and a first for you, you flew on one of the jungle jets.
That's right, mate. I got a flight on an Embraer AU-190. Wasn't really expecting that because quite often on the Melbourne to Sydney run, being part of the Golden Triangle of the Melbourne-Sydney-Brisbane route, normally you've got 737s or Qantas runs 767s, especially at the high peak period during the days. But this was on a Friday at about 11 o'clock we left, so obviously not that many people going, so better to have a packed out E190 than a two-thirds filled 737. You get much better bang for your buck as the airline if you do it that way. And yeah, a lot of fun to be on the E190. The seats were roughly about the same size in terms of capacity and dimensions and so on as the ones on the 737, but hey, there was no middle seat, so you're either an aisle or a window. It loaded pretty quickly. It really is like Honey, I Shrunk the 737, but quite a steep deck angle on approach. Really flies itself down and then flares just at the end. So yeah, it was a really good flight. Rock solid. There wasn't a lot of turbulence going up to Sydney. Coming back the next day, there was a bit here and there, but on the whole, it was all pretty good.
Now, there's been a reasonable amount of aviation news going on besides all of the festivities up there in Sydney with the International Fleet Review. But Grant, one here concerns CASA, and a report's come out regarding a crash that occurred back on August 31st, 2008, where two people were killed, and that was in a Yak aircraft, I believe. And it looks like there's been some questions raised here about CASA's ability to investigate people, particularly with regard to this pilot, Barry Hempel, who was one of the people named in the report who was killed along with his passenger, Ian Lovell. It seems that Mr. Hempel, well, a report suggesting here that perhaps he shouldn't have been in that aircraft at all.
Well, that's correct, mate. The coroner up in Queensland has released his report into the accident, and he is very damning of CASA. He's very, very upset with them. Basically, it turns out that Barry Hempel had been experiencing epileptic fits since he was hit on the head by a hangar door in 2000. He's also found that Hempel, apparently, according to the coroner, gave the impression of a man who believed he was above the law. He had more than 28,000 flying hours and numerous instances of being disciplined by CASA, apparently. But the kicker was that CASA apparently knew that he'd had these epileptic seizures. They had not referred that to a neurologist who examined Hempel. The neurologist was only given the information and supplied by Hempel himself. And then they also knew that he should not have been carrying a paying passenger because apparently he himself or his operation, it's not 100% clear, was not licensed to be carrying passengers for hire on joy flights. So, yeah, a lot of bad information there. And it's got a lot of us just totally stumped, given how CASA can suspend people at a whim. And there's plenty of stories of CASA pulling people's medicals for almost nothing, or somebody has a valid problem, but they get it resolved, everything's good, but CASA won't give them their medical back. And here's the situation where, according to the coroner, CASA knew that Hempel had epileptic seizures, and they also knew he was flying paying passengers when he shouldn't have been, and they did nothing about it. My mind's boggling. If this is all correct, then CASA's in deep trouble because they have a reputation of throwing their weight around, and clearly here, they totally ignored some very serious information.
Yes, this report's been issued by Queensland's coroner, John Hutton, and this article we find here actually in the Australian.com.au. And it says here that the coroner is quoted as saying, CASA was well aware that Mr. Hempel was a pilot who flew with total disregard for safety regulations, and goes on to say that surely even with a private pilot's license, there was a risk that he would breach a safety regulation that could place in peril any private passengers, other planes, and indeed people below his flight path. In the case of the incident on August 31, 2008, the only fortunate aspect was that the Yak landed in the open sea rather than on houses or on roads where many other people could have been killed. Now, it's interesting if he's been flying around for profit with a private pilot's license, if that's indeed what he was doing, because that's a big, big no-no. You can't charge people with a private pilot's license for your services as a pilot, as we all know, as pilots. And I tell you what, Grant, along with a few other Senate inquiries that have come out recently, CASA has certainly been in the spotlight, and for all the wrong reasons. And as much as we would like to get out there and have some good news stories about our regulator here, and I'm sure there are plenty, this sort of stuff doesn't play well for them. And CASA at the moment has declined to respond publicly in the media. A spokesman for CASA said during the week that the agency would respond to the judgment after it had been studied properly. So I guess we'll look forward to seeing what they say there, Grant. As you said, I could point to a number of situations that I know personally of friends of mine who are pilots who've had their medicals pulled for a heck of a lot less than things such as epilepsy. So there you go.
Yeah, it's
enough said about that.
It's pretty full on, mate. I'm just gobsmacked, and I'm really going to be watching to see what comes out of this one, as are a number of others.
Well, that's everything we have for you on this week's Australia Desk. And as we sign off, now listen here, Vanderhoof. I heard that comment you made about Australians stealing all the world's sports and making our own sports. And even if that is true, did they mention the yachting, Grant? They did mention the yachting, didn't they? The America's Cup yachts.
I think the American team
won it this year and beat the Kiwis. But Grant, did you hear the accent of the skipper of that boat?
Oh, Struth, mate. He didn't half sound non-American.
Now, I thought he was from Oklahoma. No. Really, you're saying he's from Melbourne?
Only Oklahoma if it's a suburb of Melbourne.
Well, it could be. Well, maybe he's from Montana or something. Who knows?
Mate, I tell you what. Yeah, it's getting really, really hard to point the finger, because I do remember sitting there chatting with my brother-in-law, who's an avid yachty, and he said there were more Kiwis on the American team than in the Kiwi team, plus a whole lot of Aussies. So I think there might have been one token Yank in the American team. Very hard to tell. And I mean, you know, it's getting to be a little bit of a joke, the America's Cup, honestly.
And we still have better football than the Americans. So there you go. The great controversy here on the Australia Desk. Until next week, I'm Steve Vischer. If David doesn't kill me.
Yeah, if they allow us back on, I'll chat to you then. I'm Grant.
Cheers, folks. Bye now.
Oh, my.
Oh, embarrassing.
Sometimes, don't you feel that when you listen to one of the Australia Desks, that sometimes you just want to go, nah, 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 nah.
Yeah, but they did it to us this time.
Yeah, I know. I didn't realize that that's the way the America Cup was put together. And that's a very interesting point. I don't think we should talk about it, though. I mean, it's the America Cup. It didn't say the America Cup. Run by a bunch of Australians and Aussies.
Yeah. Okay.
So, but anyway, we should probably move on to Peter Johnson's across the pond, because he's got Tony Bishop on talking about this cool Ego airplane that's powered by that single-engine Wankel engine. And I think it's an interesting direction, especially since we had that section or that segment earlier on the Cozy. Yeah. This one is pretty interesting as well. What do you think?
This week, we welcome Tony Bishop from Ego Aeroplanes to tell us about a really innovative new British aeroplane. Tony, welcome across the pond.
Thanks so much, Peter. Pleased to be here.
Well, it's wonderful to have you. Very exciting product. Who are Ego and why are you developing this very new innovative aircraft?
Okay, well, first of all, we're a startup company based near Cambridge in the UK, and we're now backed by a bunch of Cambridge business angels and by the local aerospace company, Marshall Aerospace.
Right, okay.
But we actually got started on this because the UK deregulated light single-seat aircraft back in 2007. It's quite similar to the US ultralight, except that we don't have a speed restriction, so we decided to do it quite a lot faster than ultralights are allowed to go about twice the speed. But actually, that wasn't the final trigger. The then Popular Flying Association set up a design competition, and I entered it with my friend Giotto Castelli. We're both aeronautical engineers.
Right.
As it happens, we both had a background in canard aircraft. So we went for a canard because particularly within the rules of the UK class, it's fundamentally more efficient. But in particular, we also wanted it to be really stylish, exciting, high-tech, all those things which all the old gas guzzlers tend not to be. anyway, we went in for this competition and rather unexpectedly won it. And immediately a lot of people said, can we have one? So we decided to build a business around it.
Right, okay.
And it's a single-seater, hence the Ego, although yep. we spell it E-G-O just to differentiate it, yep. and hence the company, of course, Ego Aeroplanes. And the other big thing about the Ego Aeroplanes now is that we've got a fantastic community of volunteers and sponsors around the project. We've got suppliers who do amazing things for us to push things a lot further. So although we've got 7 full-time staff working mainly on design and production, we do have this huge community of people around the project all adding to it.
So what is the market? What's the individual you're targeting who will fly this aircraft? We talk about light sports, but is there a particular type of person? It's a very innovative and very unique looking aircraft.
Yeah, well, I think there are a few things we see in our customers. First of all, they normally have or share at least something like a two to four seat touring aircraft. So they've got something for the long distance social flying with right. their partners and friends and so on. But, you know, we all want something more exciting as well, or different at least. And what we're finding is a lot of people would love to climb into something like an Ego and go and punch holes in the sky in the evening and just have fun for an hour. It's got quite a decent range, but I think most people will use it quite locally. The second characteristic is that we're after people who really love good design, the sort of people who appreciate, anything from an iPad to a Porsche. It's ergonomics and style as well as underneath it, of course, really good engineering.
Let's talk about that then, Tony. Tell us a little bit about particularly the power plant, which is quite innovative, and the performance of the aircraft.
Yeah, well, we've got an awful lot of performance out of an incredibly light aircraft by doing several different things. One is it's unbelievably light, 115 kilos for 100 knot single-seater.
Wow.
is not much.
Yeah.
and we've in the 6 years since we started this, it's mostly been technology development around the composite structure. We're doing some quite different things there. We've also had to make it incredibly streamlined. The drag of the aircraft is much lower than other aircraft in the class. But then, yes, the other thing is the engine, and that is quite literally revolutionary because it's a very modern take on the Wankel developed by our partners Rotron. They're another UK startup. They've basically sorted out the past problems of the Wankel, which were things like tip seal wear and high fuel usage. What we've got is an engine that's about half the weight of a four-stroke, literally half the weight, but very similar fuel consumption, very low vibration, and remarkably few parts. So it's very, very reliable and very simple to maintain.
And Tony, does that convert to good range? Or endurance, maybe?
Yes, we think we'll get well over 250 miles, maybe 300 miles in range. at about 100 knots. It's enough to get across the UK fairly comfortably.
Yeah, okay. And what sort of fuel capacity would that be? What sort of fuel usage would that entail?
We're putting in 25-litre tank.
Wow, okay. That's quite efficient.
It is. Yeah, we think we'll get over 70 miles a gallon out of it.
Wow.
For UK gallon, I should add.
Still impressive, I think, for most people. So the aircraft is still in development. What stage are you at the moment, Tony?
Well, the prototype is essentially complete and we're doing the initial ground trials right now. We've done the static tests and moving on to taxi trials. So we hope to be airborne pretty soon. Then, of course, we've got to go right through the flight test program. We have an amazing set of test pilots on this.
I was going to ask you that, and I know time's pressing on us, but a very, very impressive list of test pilots. Maybe you could just tell us a little bit about a few of them.
Well, they're all products of the still got this rather old-fashioned name, the Empire Test Pilots Training School down at Boscombe Down. Our lead test pilot, Keith Dennison, flies everything from a Blériot monoplane via a Hurricane to he was chief test pilot at BA Systems developing the Eurofighter. So he has done canards, but at the other end of the spectrum.
Sure, yeah.
And the other two have a similar range of expertise, and they've added a vast amount to both to the details of the design, of course, especially around the cockpit, but also to the whole shape of the flight test program.
So, Tony, when are we going to see the aircraft in the air, do you think?
Well, the prototype, obviously, quite soon. But we expect then to go. We got, obviously, a whole flight test program to get through, and we've got to go through a production engineering process. So that'll take, realistically, the next year or a bit more. But we plan to do the first deliveries in 2015 in the UK market. We're going to keep it to the UK initially while we iron out any bugs and really learn how to support the aircraft. But we're itching to get it into a much bigger US market as an LSA aircraft, of course.
Yeah. Well, it's very exciting. It's very innovative. It looks absolutely fantastic. We look forward to hearing a bit more about its first flights and its progress through the coming year. Tony, where can we find out about the aircraft online?
Well, we've got a website. Surprise, surprise. It's called ego.me, e-go.me. And through there, you can get on to Facebook and the Aho group and so on that we go with as well. Or you can just Google Ego Aeroplanes. Usually gets you there.
Well, Tony, do come back and tell us about your progress. But thank you very much for joining us so far.
I'd love to join you again. Thanks very much, Peter.
This is Peter Johnson, reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
All right.
Ah, yes. Yeah, beautiful Cambridge Airport. It takes me back to the days of my youth.
Oh, dear.
My first girlfriend over there lived in Cambridge, so it brings back many fond memories, none of which I intend to talk about tonight. But, you know, honestly, it's funny because I know David builds model airplanes, too. Max, did you ever build model airplanes when you were a kid?
I did for a while. Yes, I did.
Yeah. And Randy, how about you? Were you a model airplane kid?
Absolutely. Both plastic models up through U-Control line flying models, you bet.
Well, you know, it's funny because I know my daughter asked me once, maybe a year or so ago, if I'd ever thought about building an airplane to fly, and I didn't take long to say not a chance, because all I've got to say is that none of the airplanes I built as a kid have survived. So I don't think it bodes well for, you know, airplanes I might build now. I don't know. Maybe it's different. But
their ego reminds me a lot of sailplanes. The fuselage is very minimalist that way.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you ever flown anything like the ego or the cozy, any kind of aircraft configured like that? Randy?
I've just flown in a very easy one time, the only canard aircraft, and then I've flown in a couple of different powered gliders, motor gliders.
I think we're going to do a little gear switching here, and I think you're going to handle our listener mail, Max.
Rob, we have a listener story this time from Pasadena Brian. And Brian sent in his story in text. And so we asked him if there was any chance that he could record it, because we like them better in the sort of voice of the author. It turns out Brian couldn't do that because Brian has a cold right now. So he kind of suggests, well, he, I don't think he, I think he was thinking out loud really when he said that, you know, it'd be great if somebody like Micah could record his story, because Brian thought that Micah's stories were always so engaging.
You mean our main man?
Our main man. So we flipped that to Micah, mostly just to pass along the compliment that, that Brian was giving him. And within a couple of hours, Micah had Brian's story recorded. So we have for you Pasadena Brian, narrated by Micah.
The story of how I became an airplane geek is probably familiar to many. It started at an early age with my dad. My father served in the U.S. Air Force deployed to Korea during the Korean conflict. Like many boys age 7 or so, spending quality time with my father included weekends watching John Wayne-type World War II movies. Anything having to do with war and or aviation was on our viewing list. After the movie, I would ask my father about his experience in the war. Being part of the Greatest Generation, he didn't talk much about his experiences. However, he did tell me about the horrors of war and how they should never be glamorized like they often are. He did, however, tell me about how he earned his Bronze Star, pulling several fellow airmen out of a burning plane that crashed as a result of being too heavy, and how he ended up being a guest of the North Koreans for most of the war. His tortured, disfigured fingers told the story clearly. But these are different topics for another time. After the movies, sitting on our couch in front of the TV, my father would convert our seats into the cockpit of whatever planes we just saw. He explained where each of the gauges were, the position of the yoke, and the other control instruments. We even used his wingtip shoes to simulate the rudder pedals. My tiny feet hardly covered them. He would teach me to do a quick pre-flight inspection of our plane, climb into the cockpit, and taxi out of the runway for takeoff. All of this had to be done quickly because the enemy was coming our way, and we had to get airborne as soon as possible. We would set flaps, contact the tower for clearance with our made-up radio, and move the throttles to start our takeoff roll. Pulling back slightly on the yoke at rotation speed, we would become airborne. My dad would walk me through retracting the landing gear, making turns, applying the right amount of rudder, keeping the plane level, cruising, climbing, and all the other aspects of flight. It really was as though I was in the sky over some foreign land, like Snoopy hunting for the Red Baron. We never found the enemy, I think because he never wanted to kill anyone or glorify the process. So we would just fly around, and when we were running low on fuel, we would return to base. It was a magical time for me flying with my dad. We repeated this process for years. As I grew older, around the age of 15, if I remember correctly, I wanted to fly for myself. My father and I stopped flying together a few years prior, but I wanted to leave the ground in a real airplane. My father and I discussed this, and he thought the best way for me to learn how to fly was to join the Civil Air Patrol. A fellow high school classmate was in the CAP, and he spoke highly of the organization as well. At the next opportunity, my father took me out to the local airport where the CAP was having their meeting. It was interesting to see the young cadets dressed in uniforms and marching around the parking lot. I imagined myself being one of them in the weeks to come. We found the commander, and he arranged for me to go up in their 172 for an introduction flight. This would be my first real flight. Butterflies filled my stomach as I was finally getting to go up in the air. With luck, I would be able to practice for real all the elements of flying my father had taught me through the years. Within minutes of completing some of the liability paperwork, I was climbing into the plane. I remember the event like it was yesterday. When we taxied to the end of the runway, the instructor told me the three most useless things to a pilot. He said, "Runway behind you. That's why we're using every inch now. Fuel on the ground. That's why we topped off the tanks, even though we'll only be up for 30 minutes. And the third most useless thing to a pilot is the sky above us. So let's get up in the air." As you can imagine, the flight was magical. It was even better when the pilot handed the controls of the plane to me. I could hardly believe that I was flying the plane. It was just like my dad and I practiced. I made a few level turns, a few turns where we would climb, and one to descend. Again, I can't describe the feeling of actually flying the plane. It was by far the best thing I had ever done up to that part in my life. My dad was such a great teacher. It was so exciting to fly. As we approached the airport, I was hoping he would let me land the plane. I'm pretty confident with all the time I logged with my dad that I would have been able to land the plane just fine, but that wasn't to be. We taxied to the hangar, where I was met by my father. He was so proud of me when I told him I flew the plane, but yet he was so excited to have me back on terra firma. The following week, we attended the next CAP meeting. I was told about all the other areas in aviation and how I should consider them instead of pursuing my dream of becoming a pilot. If you can believe it, the CAP officers were aggressively talking me out of being a pilot. I'm not sure if they were pushing me away from being a pilot because my piloting skills were so poor or because I had enough pilots at the time. The reason really didn't matter. I was crushed. All I wanted to do was be a pilot. I didn't want to be an air traffic controller or become a mechanic. I wanted to fly. I'm sad to say at that moment I gave up on my dream of being a pilot, and I didn't step foot in a plane again until I started my business career many years after college. Unbelievably, I allowed the pinhead who was in charge of the Civil Air Patrol to destroy my dream. So if I can pass along any wisdom that 50 years of life has brought to me, don't let anyone crush your dreams. If you want to become a pilot, do it. If the CAP won't let you do it, go to a flight school, work at an airport, hang out at your local airport and talk with everyone who will listen. Don't give up on your dreams. Somewhere, somehow, you will make it happen. On a previous episode, Rob talked about how a bad instructor can turn off a student pilot. I didn't give myself the chance to have a bad instructor. My turnoff happened well before that opportunity. Again, please don't let anyone dissuade you from achieving your dreams. As for me, I'm now okay with sitting in the back of the bus. I understand what choices I made. Although the view isn't as good looking out the side window, I am totally happy enjoying my view and the experiences of flying around the world and listening to the airplane geeks. My inner wannabe pilot lives vicariously through all of you. And I will always have the memories of flying with my father. They are precious to me. Safe flying, Pasadena Brian.
Wow.
Yeah.
Nicely done, huh?
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. When I listen to this, and I know I pick on Stephen Grant a little bit. And, of course, I'm very nice to Peter because, of course, we all no, he's from England and all that. But, you know, when we listen to Micah, I can remember the first time we met him at one of the live events we did at the Air and Space, the Udvar-Hazy Center at the Air and Space Museum in D.C. What was that, maybe 3 years ago, I think?
3 years ago, yes, yes.
Yeah, and he and his mom, Harriet, came up, and yep, we had talked to her. And you know, it's amazing when we look at what we've been able to create. I mean, we've created Stephen Grant and Peter and now Micah. I mean, they are what they are because of us. I mean, don't you think?
Who's responsible for creating you, Rob?
Oh, yeah, well, that's the part we don't quite have figured out yet. I don't think anybody's
going
to stand up for that one. But it is nice to hear. And Mike, I think you did an absolutely marvelous job on that. And I just really hope we have a chance to get some more reports out of Micah.
Yeah, for sure. And thanks, Brian, for sending it in. Hope your cold is better.
Oh, yeah,
by the
Brian,
time you hear this.
We forgot about you. I'm sorry. Yeah, that's well said. And
yeah, so it's a great story, Brian. Thank you for sharing that. And for all of our listeners, if you haven't sent us your story yet, please consider doing that. Again, we like recordings better than something you've just written out. So if you can do that, that's preferable. Just think about who was that person that influenced you to be involved in aviation, or what was some kind of aviation-related experience that you've had in your life that had some kind of meaning for you, and send those in. We really like those. And we get a lot of good feedback from the rest of our listeners, too, and people like to hear those stories.
Yeah, and Brian, don't take it personally or anything like that, because we did try. It was sort of a trial and error period. We tried holding people's letters up to the cameras, but people on radio just didn't seem to get it. So I don't
work.
Know. Yeah, it didn't work.
All right. We also had gotten an email from Brian, who has visited the new Star Alliance lounge at LAX. And he was comparing to lounges that he had seen in Hong Kong and Singapore, and the how the lounges in some of those airports seemed to be a little bit nicer than some of the lounges you find in the U.S. at airports. And it's based on my experience, I would say that's generally true. Although I'll tell you, when I'm traveling the long haul across the ocean, boy, you know, any kind of a lounge for me is better than waiting at the gate.
I wouldn't know when I buy tickets. I'm just lucky they let me in the McDonald's.
Okay. We got a voicemail, a short voicemail from Jeff. This is about a real world experience with PEDs in flight, personal electronic devices. Listen to this.
Hi, geeks. This is Jeff calling from New Zealand. I just wanted to share something I observed the other day with you and your listeners. I was recently piloting a cross-country flight in a light single-engine aircraft, and my passenger decided to take some photos of a mountain range we were flying past using his smartphone. I happened to be looking at the aircraft's magnetic compass while he was taking the photos, as I was cross-checking the heading indicator with the compass to ensure we were flying the correct heading. I noticed the compass kept jumping and swinging left and right as much as 10 degrees every time my passenger took a photo. The smartphone was clearly influencing the compass, and this was without even using the transmit or receive functions of the phone. The subject of the use of personal electronic devices on aircraft regularly comes up on your show, and to those that say that PEDs can't interfere with aircraft systems, well, I would say they can, because I've seen it happen. Thanks for producing a great podcast every week, guys. Keep up the good work.
Well, that's an interesting data point, don't you think?
That's an interesting point, actually, and it's not something we hear very often. We're pretty much used to people saying, doesn't make any difference. The airplane just keeps going. But here in the States, at least, I don't believe there has yet been any research that proves anything one way or another, although the feds are, even as we speak, beginning to reflect on the kinds of restrictions we have. In fact, what I'd heard, though, is that if anything, they're planning on being more liberal with their restrictions than more conservative. But we'll see what happens. Of course, they're going to have to come back to work to get that done.
Yeah, that's right. Randy, have you run across any kind of interference from electronic devices in your extensive history?
I haven't, but then again, there's avionics and avionics, meaning that the avionics that we might have in a lot of light aircraft does not necessarily have the same testing standards that you might have in a King Air or Citation or other biz jet. So there is that. I do agree with Rob that I think that the FAA erred on the side of conservatism by saying we don't know that they're unsafe, but we don't know that they're safe, so we'll just ban them. I do think that it's interesting that as a society we have become so dependent upon these things that we cannot do without them until we reach 10,000 feet. So maybe but that's a different story, I guess. But yeah. No, I haven't personally ever experienced it.
All right. Now, Max and Rob, what is the single best IFE system in the planet?
Looking out, everybody together now. Looking out the window.
See, I'm going to keep pounding that into people's heads until they get it through their thick skulls.
Okay.
Good point.
All right. We heard from Tom. He sent us an email, a nice email on a couple of topics. One was on the subject of electronic cigarettes. Now, I don't know a lot about these, but I know that there are these cigarettes that don't contain tobacco. But I think most airlines do have restrictions against them. And he tells us about a situation where with his wife on a Delta MD-88 flight where her seatmate, the guy next to her, was sneaking puffs off of his e-cigarette during the flight. And she was sort of annoyed at the smell of it and so forth. But isn't that true? Isn't the general rule across the airlines that those are not allowed, just as real cigarettes are not allowed?
I don't think they are. They supposedly give off nothing more than harmless water vapor, but I've been able to smell them when I've been near people that use them, so I'm assuming there's got to be something more there than just water vapor.
Part of the problem to me seems like it would be that you don't always know when that's an e-cigarette someone's smoking 20, 25, 30 feet away from you. And it can just kind of cause some agitation, as some people will think that someone's smoking a cigarette, you know, when they're not. So this, it's kind of a difficult situation. I don't know if any other listeners have had any flight experiences with e-cigarettes, either positively or negatively. But I guess if you have, send them in and let's see what people think.
You know, that's interesting. Well, I've got an airline flight early in the morning tomorrow, but I'm going to have to ask them at the check-in about that. I'm almost 99% positive you can't use them, but I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. We'll see.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. We're kind of running short on time, so we'll move ahead. We heard from Arthur Rosen, who we've had as a guest on this podcast. You'll recall he has a blog. It's called My Opinion. And Arthur, remember, Rob, Arthur, the judge, always has an opinion, sometimes a very strong one. So he sent along a link to one of his recent blog posts that's titled AOPA and Its Future, where he makes some comments about past and recent AOPA presidents. And so we'll put a link to that post in the show notes. You can take a look at that. You may agree with Arthur and you may not. I think both are good. Let's just mention quickly, David, he sent in an email and a letter attached concerning marking aircraft that have ballistic recovery parachutes on them and asking about shouldn't these be marked on the aircraft so that first responders were aware of the situation. And he was wondering whether the ASTM should be involved in setting standards for this. So we did a little research, and we also contacted our past guest from the ASTM, Christine DeYoung. And it turns out that actually there is a standard for that. Let's see. This is it's ASTM 2316 that actually does cover this. We'll put some links in the show notes. One in particular is an FAA. I'll call it a presentation that talks about these ballistic recovery system devices on aircraft and how you want to treat them if you are a first responder in the event of an accident. And it's very interesting. So we'll put a link of that in the show notes. Take a look. I think you'll learn something about that. All right. I think we've run out of time again. Sorry we couldn't get to all of the listener mail. Maybe we'll try to get a little caught up next time. But if we can't, again, want to thank everyone for writing to us. Even if we don't mention your email on the show, we read them and usually we comment on them back to you. So.
Yeah, and we comment more on the ones that come with $50 bills attached. I mean, those always motivate us.
Oh, we always get those.
Me.
Yeah. We favor those, and also recordings. All right, well, that'll do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks Podcast. I want to thank you all for listening. This has been episode 269. You can find show notes at airplanegeeks.com. The shortcut is airplanegeeks.com/269. We'll have links to all the sites and things we mentioned on the show. Randy Brooks, want to thank you so much for coming on the show. Randy's Vice President of Training and Business Development with Aircraft Performance Solutions. Randy, again, thanks for joining us.
Well, in addition to that title, I am also one of the world's biggest airplane geeks, so there's no bigger pleasure for me than being with you on your show.
Fantastic. We'd love to have you back.
And you don't sound like you were random at all to me.
I have had that comment that my call sign is ironic, but it is what it is.
Yeah, okay. Maybe you could be ironic. Is there a call? Hey, ironic. I guess now that. Yeah, well, whatever.
We want to thank our contributors, Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren. You can find more of them at plaincrazydownunder.com. Also, Peter Johnson. You can find him at his Aviation Extended podcast. That's at aviation-extended.co.uk. No leading E on extended. All right, let's tell folks where they can find each of us online. And David Vanderhoof, we'll start with you.
You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on the blog at whatjustflewby.com. You can find me on our sister podcast, the UAV Digest with Max. Just Google Vanderhoof. It's not that hard. I'll come up.
Okay. We should mention too, Randy, that if folks want to find out more information about Aircraft Performance Solutions, website is apstraining.com.
That's right. And there's a great wealth of information there. I think people will be interested in finding out more about upset prevention recovery training. It's all there on our site.
great. Now it's time for Rob Mark. Rob, what are some of the places where folks can find you online?
Well, contrary to popular belief, if you go up to the APStraining.com site, you will not find the video that Otter and I shot when I was out in the extra. And so for those of you that are thinking maybe you can catch a quick glimpse of me getting sick in the extra, it didn't happen, guys. It was way too cool. So anyway, you can find us at jetwine.com, which is the blog, and of course, Jetwine on Twitter, and they'll find me up on Facebook. And I like David's idea, actually. Just you want me, Google my name, and hopefully none of my my past erratic behavior will show up in Google anywhere.
So I'm Max Flight. Look for me on Google Plus and Twitter as Max Flight. Also, as David mentioned, at theuavdigest.com. Now be sure to follow Airplane Geeks on Twitter, Facebook, and Google Plus. We're also on Stitcher.com, where you can stream us to your mobile phone or your automobile if you are so equipped. You can also find us on tunein.com. We have an email address if you'd like to send us an email. That's thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And of course, we have a listener line where you can leave us an audio message. Our lovely Aunt Benet will tell us that number.
The Airplane Geeks want to hear from you, so please give them a call at 361-GEEKS-01.
Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night, everybody. Thanks.
Thanks for listening.
What's the meaning of this? And what's the meaning of that awful village people music running underneath this?
Well, I don't know. You're the one who selected the music.
Oh, yeah.
I'll tell you what.
Whoops.
I'll tell you what. You may have been getting off on football, you poor bugger, but I at least got off on some of the hot... no, I can rephrase that. I was about to say hot.
Oh!
Yeah, no.
Hello,
no, no.
Sailor. Oh.
I wasn't going there, Doug.
I know you've been in Sydney, but geez. Anyway, okay. Outtake number one.
Darlinghurst, no less. Going, whoa, over some really good equipment.
Bloody hell. Marker, outtake number two.
No, because I was heading towards going, I was getting off on some really good equipment. Then I was realizing this could be bad.
Will we take this from the top, shall we, old friend?
Yeah. I don't know. I think the hole just keeps getting bigger. I'm enjoying the digging's great for me.
This is going to be a case where the outtake reel is longer than the actual segment.
I don't know. Again, I just can't imagine flying an airplane I built. But
I wouldn't fly Max. One that you built either.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, that was really funny, Max.
Okay, sure. There, you can stream us right to your mobile to phone. Mobile to phone. You can
mobile to phone.
Mobile to phone.
Phone.
Stream us to the phone. Oh, jeez.